Well, the Food and Drug Administration is supposed to be there to protect you. But is it doing what it's supposed to do? In a moment, Jonathan Emore joins us. You know, he has gone to court and has won seven times. Seven times he's defeated the FDA in court. We're going to be talking to him about all these issues in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Jonathan Emore, principal of Emord and Associates, practices constitutional and administrative law in D.C. before the federal agencies. He's the only attorney in history that has defeated the FDA, Food and Drug Administration, seven times in federal court, six times on First Amendment grounds. He began his legal career as an attorney in the Mass Media Bureau of the Federal Communications Commission in 1985 during the Reagan administration. And here he is. A couple topics, actually, we're going to talk with Jonathan about today. The first will deal with the FDA and censorship, and here he is back on Coast to Coast. Hey, Jonathan, how are you? Happy holidays to you.
Happy holidays to you, George. Great to be here.
Looking forward. Well, I'm in the Midwest. I left Los Angeles to spend some time with the family here for Christmas, and we have been getting battered by the worst weather I've seen in years. It's just truly unbelievable. I trust it's okay where you are?
It's okay here. I spent many years in Chicago, and boy, oh boy, I know how cold it can be there.
Yeah. You know what it's all about. Tell me what's going on with the FDA these days, Jonathan. You know, we get these drugs that are supposed to be tested, then they're approved, then they hit the market, and then they're taken off after a year or two because people die. Something happens. They're supposed to be a watchdog for us. Are they doing their job?
Well, the scientists at FDA are, but the political appointees are largely beholden to the drug industry. It's the agency is a captive of the drug industry, unfortunately, and that has caused it to be a broken agency. It approves unsafe drugs knowingly, and that is a shocker to most Americans. Just as late as January 7, 2009, nine FDA physicians and scientists in desperation wrote to then Chief of Staff John Podesta that managers, and those are the political appointees at FDA, have ordered, intimidated, and coerced FDA experts to modify scientific evaluations, conclusions, and recommendations in violation of the law, and to accept clinical and technical data that is not scientifically valid. That's a very potent indictment, a continuing indictment of the FDA for its approval of unsafe drugs.
You explain in your book, The Rise of Tyranny, that the FDA has knowingly approved unsafe drugs because the agency, as you say, is a captive of the drug industry, as you've talked about. Is this administration any different than, let's say, the prior ones in this regard?
Well, it is slightly different in that they're investing a lot more money in enforcement actions, but Commissioner Hamburg and her political appointees have not done anything substantive to change the extent to which the drug industry exercises undue influence over the drug approval process. And so the basic dynamics that I described in The Rise of Tyranny, which people can obtain through my website at emord.com via amazon.com, secure link, that story is the same. And it's actually becoming worse as the FDA becomes receives far more money and political support from Congress. Congress, too, is to blame. Congress is heavily influenced by the drug industry and itself has done nothing substantive to change this dynamic of undue influence over the drug approval process.
Let's grab a drug and have you go through it. Tell us the process, what happened to it, and what happened to it now. Avandia, of course, used for type 2 diabetes, which millions of Americans have.
Well, Avandia, this is a really an amazing story of a disgusting one of FDA complicity with the drug industry here at GlaxoSmithKline to approve a drug that really is far too unsafe to be in the marketplace. The FDA's medical reviewer, Dr. Robert Misben, objected to the agency's approval of the drug in an April 2, 1999 memo to his superiors. He identified at that time, before the drug was approved, that he said, there were serious, deleterious long-term effects on the heart from the drug, and he expressed those concerns to his superiors and recommended that the drug not be approved. His criticisms were rejected. In May of 99, FDA approved the drug for marketing and made no reference to the heart risks. Misben was ostracized within the agency. In one interview, he said, "My superiors have said something to me that I have never forgotten, that we have to maintain good relations with the drug companies because they are our customers." Oh, the language within the agency. So then in February of 2006, another FDA medical reviewer came public, Dr. Rosemary Johann Ling, strenuously objecting to the FDA allowing the drug to be marketed without warnings to the public about the heart attack risks. And her superiors at FDA told her that they were upset with her because of the recommendation and that they decided to act like her review never happened. Then Congressman Diane Watson from California said that in hearings on Avandia that she had been prescribed the drug by her doctor and she developed a heart murmur. And she attributed that to Avandia in the hearing and asked the FDA commissioner, "How could you allow this drug to be marketed that's so unsafe?" The answers were unacceptable to Congress. Then in May of 2007, a meta-analysis in the New England Journal of Medicine showed that the drug increased the risk of heart attack by 43%. And even this didn't stop FDA from defending the drug. It had an advisory panel with conflicts of interest assembled to review Avandia. And while the panel decided that there was this increased risk of heart attack, they voted to keep the drug on the market anyway. Then in August of 2007, FDA reversed itself under tremendous political pressure from Congress and did what it told Dr. Johann Ling it never would do, which is put a black box warning on Avandia about its heart risks. Then in February of this year, the FDA's Associate Director of Drug Safety, David Graham, it came forward recommending that Avandia be taken off the market because it was too unsafe. Graham said that Avandia caused 500 more heart attacks and 300 more heart failures than its leading competitor. In June of this year, Dr. Graham and his colleagues published a JAMA article on Avandia, evaluating 227,571 elderly patients and comparing Avandia to its leading competitor, which is the Abbott drug Actos. And he concluded that Avandia was associated with an increased risk of stroke, heart failure, and all-cause mortality, and an increased risk of the myocardial infarction, acute myocardial infarction, stroke, heart failure, and all-cause mortality in patients 65 and older. And then in July, under pressure from Graham and from Congress, FDA convened a review panel, an advisory committee meeting on Avandia cardiovascular risks. Everyone was thinking at that point, look, it's too much. There's been so much negative information now that the FDA can't allow this thing to stay on the market. Then on September 23rd, under this administration, FDA refused to remove the drug on the market, and it instead restricted its marketing, but kept new patients on the drug, not recommending that they be taken off, not recommending that doctors tell them to take the drug off.
Was there incompetence here, Jonathan, or is there something else afoot?
There is supreme competence. There's no element of a lack of ability. This is politics, pure and simple. Politics ruling the process. It's proof positive that the drug industry carries enormous sway. When you have all this information, and we're talking about thousands, over 80,000 adverse event reports pouring into the FDA about this drug. 83,000 heart attacks were linked to the drug between 1999 and 2007 within the FDA's own files. And in congressional hearings on this drug, Senate Finance Committee, they had an ongoing inquiry into the drug, and they found that GlaxoSmithKline had withheld studies from the FDA and the public about serious heart attack risks. They found that, they said, the totality of the evidence suggests that GSK was aware of the possible cardiac risks many years before the evidence became public, and that GSK had this duty to warn patients but did not do so, and that GSK executives actually intimidated independent physicians focused on strategies to minimize findings that Avandia may increase cardiovascular risk and sought ways to downplay findings that their rival drug, Actos, might reduce cardiovascular risk. And actually what they ended up finding was that GlaxoSmithKline even was involved in a ghostwriting campaign where it would solicit articles to be written favorable about the drug by physicians and then have them published in medical journals without the journals knowing that the company was behind it.
Well, see, I was just going to ask you that. When the big companies conduct their own research, are they doing it with the marketing in mind? They're looking for something to take to the FDA, or do they want to really find out if this stuff works or not? Is anybody getting hurt? Whether they release it or not is another question. But I mean, what's their main approach when they do their own studies?
Well, oftentimes they start the whole process with a PR firm. They have PR firms that are specifically dedicated to maintaining relationships with specific physicians and scientists, helping provide financing to their universities and their chairs at the universities, and causing these people to conduct specific parts of scientific research that they suspect strongly, based on their own internal records and evaluation, will result in favorable findings. And oftentimes, these scientists only have a narrow view of the entire project. They are not given the full scientific evaluation such that they can make a decision that, hey, look, this doesn't work. Other times, they're given that, but they're under confidentiality agreements that forbid them from communicating to the public the total findings, and they're under obligations to publish. So you'll have a publication about a drug that looks very favorable, but that's only because it looks at a narrow body of data, not the whole picture, and you end up with a misimpression. And that is communicated to physicians and to others, and they think the drug is safe and has utility. That's the very type of thing that happened here with this Avandia.
Is there any criminal culpability here by the companies or by some people on the FDA committees?
Well, there is criminal culpability, but the Justice Department simply does not prosecute. We've had instances under the Obama administration, which started to look promising and seemed to be going in the right direction, where they called to task drug company executives for participating in these sorts of things, but they settled with them, and they allowed them to pay to the United States Treasury large sums of money, many, many millions of dollars, and get off the hook. And there they are doing the same thing. In fact, with one of the drug companies that was under investigation, while the drug company was under investigation and telling FDA that it was sorry for its malfeasance, it was engaged in the very same malfeasance. Yet it only the Justice Department settled with them and accepted the money and didn't do anything about the ongoing malfeasance.
All right. Tell me about this other drug that's out there, Byetta. What is that?
Well, Byetta is another type 2 diabetes drug, but it also has very serious adverse consequences. That drug is linked to acute pancreatitis, renal insufficiency, kidney failure, and pancreatic cancer. It's another instance where FDA, aware of the risks associated with that drug, put it on the market and is accepting those risks, and they are really unacceptable. Physicians, by the way, are largely unaware of this data because the FDA, once it approves a drug, has put its stamp on that drug that it is safe and efficacious for its use. You know, you don't think that a drug is going to kill you if it's been approved by the FDA. That may be a perfect solution to all of your health problems. They won't recur if you're dead. But the patient, of course, does not want to be at risk. And the physician doesn't really comprehend the full extent to which a drug can affect these risks when it has the FDA's approval behind it.
The scientists who work for the big pharma companies who develop these drugs, do they do so wanting to truly help people? Are they trying to make big money for themselves? I mean, what's going on there?
Well, they're functionaries, and you know they're under significant restrictions, so that you have these people who are within the drug companies working on these agents, and they, again, have this narrow window. They're given a specific task, and they perform that task. The big picture is farmed out to others, and the overall picture is put together by lawyers and by the PR firms and by select scientific input. But they're not really given the opportunity to pass upon whether they think a drug is safe, sufficiently safe. They're given the job of doing a specific function, and then reporting to their superiors. In the end, there are the executives who are responsible. They know what's going on. They know the big picture. They know the relative degree of risk that they're assuming. They really bet on their drugs. What they do is they come to the conclusion, this drug is going to likely cause death or cause adverse effects in a certain percentage of the population, but it will be marketed for years and years before, if ever, the causality can be proven. The problem with drugs is that they treat sick people, and sick people die. And so it's very difficult, oftentimes impossible, to prove that the drug, the agent in the drug, is actually the catalyst for the events that result in someone's death. And so drug companies get away with it. That's why, you know, you have something like Vioxx, which increases your risk of heart attack and stroke substantially, and it could be marketed for over a decade before enough scientific evidence was accumulated to indict that drug as unsafe. It's a tragedy, but the real culpability here lies with the executives within these companies who put a bullet into the chamber knowing that someone's going to pull the trigger and it's going to kill them.
And, you know, I have found, for example, the best way to fight off type 2 diabetes or even pre-type 2, lose some weight, you know, to watch what you eat, you know, stay away from a lot of glucose type foods, and you'll watch those glucose levels plunder down. Jonathan, that's how you do it.
Well, that works for a large number of people, and it is the best way to go. But in a certain percentage of people, even with weight reduction, they still have that type 2 diabetes, and it becomes a difficult situation for them because they really are beholden to their doctors to figure out what to do. And whenever they're taking a drug, they're at risk. But clearly, some drugs are so risky, like Avandia, that no one should be taking them.
I want to talk with you in a few moments about aspirin and what that all means and whether it's truly good for us or not, because there's conflicting data coming out, and I suspect it's good for us, it's simple, it's cheap, but, you know, they probably don't want us to know that. When Big Pharma hears programs like this and they hear you on it, do they go nuts or do they just say, let's just ignore it?
Well, they oftentimes weather the storm. Like with Avandia, you know, the company has already decided that this thing is going to be a loss leader. They've made an enormous amount of money. Just last year, they made like $1.2 billion on the drug, but these restrictions and all the negative publicity are making it, a loss leader in the future. But recognize that they've been profiting on this thing since 1999, and hugely profiting.
Sure.
And even with this loss situation, they're still way ahead. So, you know, it's just time to go on, move on to the next agent. They keep introducing drugs for the same conditions year after year, calling them the panacea. They never are.
They're trying to increase market share, aren't they?
Exactly. That's their job.
Yeah, well, and you know what? They're all publicly held companies, and they've got their shareholders, and they need to increase revenue. And the only way you can increase revenue is to come up with more product and sell what you have. It's a business to them. And that's scary, isn't it?
It is scary. I'm all for a free market, but that's not what exists in the drug market. These are government-sponsored or created monopolies. We don't have a free market. You can't get, if you're a professor at a university and in the course of your research you discover that there's an agent that has a significant effect on reducing the risk of some sort of cancer, you can't go to the FDA with that and expect it to be approved. There's absolutely no way. It'll cost you at least $290,000 to just pay the filing fees at the FDA, and then to prosecute that application to fruition, you have to go through so many hoops. Unless you're connected, you can't get there. It costs about $1.6 billion to get a drug through the FDA.
Gosh, we're going to be back in a moment, Jonathan, to talk about plain old aspirin on Coast to Coast AM. Jonathan, in your opinion, what percent of drugs that are out there in the marketplace are really bad, just not good for people?
I'd say about 15 to 20% of all FDA-approved drugs are so obviously unsafe as to warrant their removal from the market.
What percent would you say are truly effective? They help people.
I'd say a good 75-80%. The advantages of having those drugs available exceed the disadvantages associated with the adverse events.
But okay.
It's that, unfortunately, the 15-20% are largely relatively new drugs over the last decade, and they replace drugs that were safer than those. And the reason's entirely based on profitability. The other drugs have gone off patent, so they are open to competition in the market. Drug companies want to replace them with drugs that are on patent and that can't be, therefore they have a monopoly. And they're willing to do that and reap those profits because even with the increased risks, and the FDA is complicit in that. It's enough so that we're witnessing with drugs in this country over 290,000 deaths a year from the proper use of drugs prescribed by doctors.
Jeez. Can you imagine that? Somebody's given a prescription to make themselves better and they end up dying because they take it?
I suspect that a good percentage of your listeners have been prescribed a drug by a doctor and have had a significant adverse effect associated with it, have gone back to the doctor, and the doctor has said, okay, don't take that anymore. What about those who take the drug, experience the effect, don't know that it's from the drug, think it might be a further progression of the disease, keep taking it and die? That's the real problem. It's a significant one, and it's resulting in about 290,000 deaths a year in this country.
Well, we'll find out when we take some phone calls in a couple hours. I'm sure we'll get all kinds of calls. Is science telling us the truth when they say you got to take your entire prescribed, batch of antibiotics or whatever you have, it's going to become immune and it's not going to work for you ever again? They keep changing antibiotics. The old ones, they say, are no good anymore. Are they telling us the truth here, or is this a ploy to increase market share with new antibiotics?
Well, there is a real problem with bacteria resistance to antibiotics, mutations of bacteria to overcome obstacles that are presented by drugs. But unfortunately, using that as an excuse, the drug industry pumps out year after year drugs like Ketek and Levaquin that are antibiotics that have significant adverse effects. Ketek causes liver failure. Levaquin causes all sorts of neurological and even skin problems in some people.
What about Cipro?
Cipro is in the same category as Levaquin. A good number of people can benefit from it, but there are a lot of people that can be severely disabled, including having ruptured tendons. And so these are not, they're prescribed so liberally, but they shouldn't be. They should be recognized as dangerous drugs that have to be restricted, and people must be carefully observed, and they must be warned. And all of this ordinarily does not happen when a physician just says, okay, here's your prescription, see you later.
Exactly. Tell me about aspirin. What's going on there?
Well, aspirin is one of those drugs that really is, in many respects, a true wonder drug. Old drug for pain relief, we're now finding out, has a number of benefits. On December 7th of this year, in the British medical journal Lancet, the authors, Professor Rothwell and others, evaluated data from 8 randomized trials of aspirin, 25,570 patients, and found that data revealed a significant reduction in colorectal and gastrointestinal cancers, and also a reduction in other cancers, including esophageal, pancreatic, brain, and lung. And that's from low-dose aspirin, 81 milligrams. It reduced the death to several forms of cancer in elderly people. And these are significant. This is a significant finding, and it suggests that the other findings about aspirin that are now well accepted, that aspirin reduces the risk of heart attack and stroke, is complemented with this. The downside is that aspirin can cause gastric bleeding, but a good number of people in consultation with their physicians should consider taking aspirin because of these enormous benefits daily.
Well, and we do know it's good for your heart.
It is.
The the aspirin was derived from the willow bark, wasn't it?
Yes, and there's synthetic versions of it. The government has been, aspirin's an interesting story with the FDA because aspirin precedes the FDA's drug approval process. It's a grandfathered drug. And as a consequence, it never went through the hoops at FDA that the other ones do. So it's viewed somewhat skeptically and jealously by the FDA. And the idea is that it needs to be contained in what is said about it, even when that information is life-saving.
What about supplements, Jonathan? I mean, I would assume Big Pharma would love to get supplements controlled by them, off the market, maybe. What do you think?
Absolutely. This has been a historic effort on the part of the FDA and the pharmaceutical industry. In my book, Global Censorship of Health Information, which is also available through emword.com with a link to Amazon, I explain in detail this whole paradigm, the history of it. The drug industry fears that if the public becomes aware that specific nutrients have pharmacological effects, have treatment effects on disease, that people will engage in self-treatment, will rely upon these agents as disease risk factors. That messes up the paradigm that is created by the FDA's process. That paradigm is you must go to a doctor. The doctor is the conduit through which you get treatment. And that treatment will consist of a pharmacological agent approved by FDA as a drug. When people start realizing that lifestyle modification, relying upon nutrients at above RDI doses, can result in a reduction in the risk of disease and may prevent a disease altogether, then they become healthier, longer, and they rely far less on these pharmacological agents, and they will consume far fewer of them in a lifetime. The overall effect is to shift the profitability down and to increase self-reliance. And the notion then becomes, well, my goodness, if I can rely on these things to prevent or mitigate disease, why do I have to rely so heavily on drugs? And that awareness is a threat to drug company profitability. So the FDA, with an absolute hammer, prior restraint, forbids any statement that a nutrient treats a disease. It is illegal in this country to state it. Whether you have proof to support it or not is absolutely illegal. So it's a prior restraint that is antithetical to the core values of the First Amendment. If there was anything that the First Amendment was designed to do, that James Madison in introducing it intended it to do, it was to strip this government of the power to prevent people from speaking in the first instance. Yet this prior restraint is like it was in the courts of Star Chamber in the 15th century England. It is a brutal one, and armed agents of the FDA and the Marshal Service and local baby FDAs daily go into the offices of companies and seize their inventory and remove all of their property largely, and prosecute these people, and sometimes put them in jail for up to 20 years, simply for telling the truth about nutrients. That's not to say that everybody out there is telling the truth. There are a lot of frauds. But actually, that fraud is promoted by this censorship, because the censorship keeps truthful information out, which could help ferret out falsehood. You know, if you knew more about nutrients, you wouldn't be so willing to accept representations made that are false. And the FDA, if it devoted its attention to just going after falsehood, would be celebrated, but it isn't.
Well, and that's true. And you know, one of the dangers of all this, it's like, you know, the boy who cried wolf, Jonathan, you sometimes wonder, who do you believe? You know, the FDA comes out and says, well, you know, these supplements are bad for you. You can't take them. Don't take a lot of vitamin D. Then I read that vitamin D3 could be one of the wonder drugs, supplements to fight off cancer and other ills. But, you know, you sit back and you go, all right, who do you believe? There's obviously some people out there trying to make a buck, and they could be frauds. Maybe government is trying to help us, but because of their track record, I don't trust them. Is that a normal feeling?
Well, the reality, the truth out there in science is that nothing, almost nothing, is provable to a conclusive degree. So there's always an ugly dark side. And that dark side doesn't mean that the thing won't work. It raises questions about it. Sometimes it means it doesn't work, but oftentimes it just raises questions about it. The problem we have is that FDA sits there as a big health sensor and blocks information about the deleterious effects of drugs it approves from reaching consumers and physicians, and blocks beneficial information about supplements from reaching the market to protect this regime where it serves as the gatekeeper on the information. And as a consequence, people are left in the situation where they one day hear about a study that was negative about a supplement. There may be 150 studies that are favorable about that product, and this may be the only study that's negative. But suddenly it's in the news, and for the moment they think, oh, I'd better not take beta-carotene, for example. Well, that's really a bunch of rot. What the public needs to know is that there is an association between, say, beta-carotene and reduction in the risk of certain kinds of cancers, mm-hmm. and that the evidence, however, is not conclusive. It's not definitive. There's still debate going on. And then they can make their own judgment. Someone can say, okay, well, look, I'm going to bet that those studies that favor this thing are right, and I'm going to take that product. And others will say, well, there is some skepticism there. I'm going to wait. But that is precisely why the First Amendment protects our sovereignty and our right to make those decisions. It should not be the government sitting there saying, we'll let you receive this information, and we won't let you receive this other information, because we think if you're entrusted with the information we're blocking, you might not make a good choice, a choice we think is in your best interest. That paternalism, that nanny state, is exactly what the FDA is, and it's depriving us of the freedom to decide our own biological destiny. It is robbing us of the chance to make decisions that could enhance our lives based on a sound, rational judgment on information.
We think, and some of the people I continue to interview believe, that cancer thrives in an acidic body more so than an alkaline body. And so the theory is balance yourself, balance your pH levels. If this is correct, and I'm beginning to truly believe, Jonathan, it is. Why doesn't the FDA try to very simply teach people, all right, here's a source that we can test people with cancer, and maybe most of them will have this high acidic level. We can then conclude that if you have cancer, you have an acidic body, or if you have an acidic body, you're more prone to cancer. Why don't they do studies like that for people?
Well, this is a good topic, one that is oftentimes addressed at a thing. I'm going to speak at the Health Freedom Expo March 25th in Long Beach, California. And that expo has many people who talk about exactly what you're mentioning here. The website is healthfreedomexpo.com, and the Health Keepers Alliance puts that show on. It's really an eye-opening experience for many people. Yes, it is a situation where there's a large body of evidence on lifestyle and on balance in diet and how that can prolong life and reduce the risk of disease. But the FDA, even after I petitioned the FDA to use its power, its website and so forth, to communicate emerging science to the public so that people can be educated about it, to be a information promoter instead of an information suppressor, and to trust the American people. But that destroys the entire reason for FDA's existence, and they won't do it. The FDA is not in the business of ensuring that people have full information. It's in the business of channeling information, and it's influenced in that channeling by the economic interests of those who largely control it. It wants the public to be informed of only part of the message, and that will lead them to make economic decisions that benefit its principal regulatee, which is the drug industry. That's how FDA works. It is a massive regime, enormous agency, that regulates one quarter of the American economy and does so in a way that directly affects our choices and oftentimes causes us to make fundamental decisions that reduce our livelihood, that make it difficult for us to live to old age. I mean, all those people who died from Vioxx, all those people who have died taking Avandia, all those people who are dying taking drugs like Cerevent for asthma, which dramatically increases the risk of death from asthma.
Jeez.
These people have been robbed of a future because the FDA will not allow into the marketplace enough information about the harms, and furthermore, because the FDA has stupidly let these drugs onto the market, even though the risks are enormous. It has done so because there is a revolving door at FDA. I mean, people who work at FDA in political positions oftentimes end up, after they leave, either in drug companies or in positions that are largely financed by the very drug companies that they protected while in office. That's well known. When you go in as an FDA commissioner, you know you're going to leave. And you know when you leave, you're going to have friends and enemies. And the worst thing for the FDA commissioner is to make the largest monopolies in the world that have economic clout that influences every medical school, every single pharmacy, and even the practice of medicine, to consider you persona non grata and to make it difficult when you leave to be employed. So what they do is they feather their own nests by favoring those companies. They look the other way and let the bad apples out, because they realize that they're going to get paid back. And that's the real story.
Do these people have a conscience?
Well, they do have a conscience. Unfortunately, it is influenced largely by a desire to be acceptable to specific politicians and to the major industries that are served by the agency. These people realize, even long before they get into the position of being an FDA commissioner, they go through a number of hoops. They have to pass through and be acceptable to Congress. They have to be acceptable to major industry players, or else they'll never be nominated. And once they're nominated, they realize the only way they're going to get through is by assuring specific members of Congress that they're going to play this game. And when they get there, assuring their senior advisors and those who have been there in political positions through every administration that they're going to play this game. And so they do it. And they wouldn't be there if they weren't willing to play that game. These people are not ordinarily of stellar character, in my judgment. These people are absolutely self-interested. And they speak a good public interest bit on television and before Congress. But the fact of the matter is, you cannot explain why these drugs that are so unsafe that the FDA's own medical reviewers objected to have been approved again and again. And that story, I mean, in much more detail in The Rise of Tyranny and Global Censorship of Health Information, I explain this whole process. It's not a unique circumstance to this administration. It happens in Republican and Democratic administrations alike. This agency really is in dire need of having its power taken from it, of being reduced, and that power instead being divvied up elsewhere to assure the public safe drugs.
It's almost as if their God is green, Jonathan. When we come back, we're going to talk with you about unmanned aerial vehicles. That's right. You're involved in this area, too. We'll find out why.